Hello and welcome to the Hopkins Biotech Podcast, where we illuminate life science career opportunities outside of academia through the experiences of those who have been there before. For updates about upcoming guests, follow us on social media and visit us at hopkinsbiotechpodcast.com to check out our full catalog of episodes. This episode is the seventh part of the Boston Biotech series, produced in collaboration with the Professional Development and Career Office at the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine. In this series, we talk with alumni who work in the Boston Biotech ecosystem. If you are a Hopkins student, we encourage you to join the online Boston Biotech community on the OneHop platform to connect with the podcast guests, as well as other JHU alumni who work in Boston. You can find the link on our website at hopkinsbiotechpodcast.com or in the show notes. My name is Jenna Glatzer, and I'm joined here with my co-host.
I'm Joe Varielli. And our guest today is Dr. Karina Klingman. Karina is a principal and founder of Recruitomics BioTalent Consulting, a privately held biotechnology hiring and recruitment consulting agency. Their recruiters are all PhD-level scientists with various specializations, enabling them to offer a variety of services for both candidates and hiring managers. Karina was also the sponsorship co-chair for their Boston Women in Bio organization, a national group committed to promoting careers, leadership, and entrepreneurship for women in the life sciences. Prior to Recruitomics, Karina trained as a biochemist, receiving her PhD in biochemistry and molecular pharmacology from the University of Massachusetts Medical School, where she developed small molecule inhibitor screens for RNA binding proteins. Karina, thank you so much for joining us on the program today.
Thanks, and thanks for the nice introduction. I'm glad to be here.
So we're really excited to talk to you today about scientific recruiting and your journey away from the bench, but I think we should start by learning a bit more about Karina before Recruitomics to set the stage for your story as a founder. So what drew you to enroll in your PhD program and what really fueled your passion for science?
That's a great question. I had a meandering road. I think that a lot of your listeners and maybe you too can relate to that. I actually wanted to be a vet growing up. So I'm an avid horseback rider. I ride dressage and I always thought that I would be a vet. And so I did the whole pre-vet thing. And just like pre-med, you shadow, you work at vet clinics, you do all of your work hours and volunteer hours. And I just really didn't enjoy that, to be honest. And at the same time, I was working in a lab in my undergrad. And we were looking at the lab was varied. It was an animal science lab. So they were studying things in the context of animal science, like milk proteins, for instance, and how we might, actually this was back in the early 2000s, but how we might use cows to produce drugs through their mammary glands. So that's kind of an interesting place I started. And so I ended up being kind of a undergraduate lab grunt, doing a lot of Western blots. We were doing microarrays, which was back before deep sequencing. And I just really enjoyed that. And I was not enjoying my vet research, or my vet, I should say, shadow and internships and shadowing. So I decided to think about that. And my advisor at the time, the PI of that lab, was really instrumental in helping me sort of look at what I was passionate about and what excited me. And this was right around the time Craig Mello Andy won their Nobel Prize for RNA, small RNAs. So that was an exciting time in the RNA field. And that was something that I knew nothing about, but was really excited about reading. And back then, I was in California. And so I started exploring PhD programs in California, of course. And so I went and looked at Stanford and Berkeley and sort of all of the Bay Area schools. And then I was invited to come out to Worcester because I was applying to those schools. I don't know how UMass Medical School got a hold of those sorts of records that I was applying, but they did somehow. And I was invited to come interview at UMass Medical School, which was Craig Mello's home. And so I went and I just fell in love with the faculty, the school, the way it was set up. It was so interdisciplinary. Each floor housed so many different types of labs. And it was really becoming an RNA hotbed at that time. So that's what got me here. It was sort of a happy accident, I would say.
So just having been introduced to you and your story, I think it's really, really interesting and unique that you found a way to sort of turn your advanced degree in from your PhD research to address kind of a really important problem about hiring processes. So I'm wondering what kind of drew you to that sector and what was the issue you saw with the hiring process?
Yeah, so that that came about right at the end of my graduate career. I started applying. So at first, when I had entered graduate school, I did think I wanted to run maybe my own lab and stay in academia and be a PI. And that as in 2008, when I first joined my program, the funding situation was, I wouldn't say ever great, but it was okay. It was decent. There were grants going around. My lab was a small lab. We collaborated with some of the bigger labs. We had a nice collaboration with Craig Mello's lab, for instance, but I didn't have to be in that lab. I had great funding. I had my own R01. And so things were nice. And then it just became progressively harder to get funding. And you guys might be able to relate to that struggle. And my PI certainly became a little bit, disenfranchised somewhat. Not to the point where he wanted to quit, but it was obvious that it was just grant writing day in, day out, and much less of the science that he loved doing, and much less being in the lab and mentoring us. And so I started to think about going into industry where the funding situation is very different. And some of my friends who had gone into industry were talking about how, you know, they had their own set of multi-channel pipettes, all theirs that they just got to use whenever they wanted. And these sorts of things were kind of eye-opening for me. So I started applying. And as I was having interviews with recruiters, scientific recruiters, it became clear that they didn't have a scientific background. And that's not necessarily a bad thing, but it was challenging for somebody like myself who really didn't know much about the industry or what the jobs would entail, what I was sort of getting into, to not be able to ask those sorts of questions. And then as you two just introduced your background to me before this, you're sort of interdisciplinary, both of you. And, as a biochemist, yes, I have a lot of tools in my tool belt that are biochemistry related, but I don't do every type of biochemistry. I don't do every single thing, right? That's what collaborations are for. And so it became clear when I was getting outreach for NMR jobs, I don't do NMR. I did collaborate with someone on a paper one time. But that sort of thing, those distinctions are not always clear unless you've sort of done it and seen it and been, you know, in the seminars with all of the different, you know, folks at your program. So I realized that there was a niche there that could be filled by somebody with a strong scientific background, a love of the science, maybe somebody who wanted to leave the bench, which was me eventually. Although it became immediate, but I always knew I was going to be working my way away from the bench at some point. And so I thought about, I've always been very entrepreneurial, and I thought perhaps I could tackle that problem. So I founded a little company, and I had a good support network at that time, and I was able to leave my PhD program without a job and support myself, or be supported, I should say, for about 6 months until I landed my first client, which was Moderna.
Not a bad first client.
Yeah. So I think in 2021, especially in the age of LinkedIn, many people seem to connote recruiting with, like you had mentioned, sometimes often erroneous emails or messages that you might receive for jobs that are frankly kind of irrelevant. And it's often an impersonal process. And it seems like your approach at Recruitomics is trying to sort of break that stigma within the life sciences industry. So what exactly is it that you do differently in order to create a more personal and let's call it a targeted approach to recruiting?
Yeah, it actually starts with our clients. So this starts well before we ever do outreach to a single candidate for a job. So there are multiple types of recruiters out there and recruiting models. So the types that people are most familiar with are not going to be mine because I created sort of a new model. But most people are familiar with more of a sort of quote unquote headhunter type of person. And those individuals are typically not hired directly by the company, but they're paid sort of a fee if they do land a candidate in a role. And so that leads to a really impersonal experience for kind of everyone, for the company and for the candidates, because there isn't a real meeting of the minds and who we're looking for, what type of a person. And so that's one model, and that's called a contingency recruiter. Another model is a retained search model, where you see that often at like executive search level, so C-level or even, you know, VP, SVP level. And those firms, they usually have big impressive names like Klein Hersh and Korn Ferry. And those are kind of the powerhouses of the industry. And those types of firms get a fee upfront, usually 30% of the placement fee upfront. And whether they ever hire somebody or not, that fee is gone. And then they work to engage these executive level people. And so those are the two major models of recruiting. And then there are some internal models that are kind of a part-time or a contract recruiter that would come into the company for a short term, maybe not be a full-time employee, and recruit internally, or there are the full-time internal recruiters. Now, those types of people typically don't do as much recruiting as you would think. They look at applicants, they screen applicants, and then they coordinate the interview process. So that's a very internal type of role. So we wanted to bridge the gap between that piece, that sort of internal process-driven piece that's very in contact with the company, and the contingency piece, those are the people who are out engaging the candidates. We wanted all of that to be in-house, but we also didn't want to do it in the traditional fee structure. So I created a model that's a consulting model. We work directly with our clients on an hourly consulting basis, and we provide a full service approach, which allows baby companies. We love the startups. So we go into baby companies that don't have any recruiting infrastructure or expertise, and we just become their talent acquisition function, the whole thing, soup to nuts. And it allows them to have that function without having to hire a head of TA, a recruiter, a scheduler, sort of that whole team. And they can just pay for that on an hourly basis. So that's what we do to start. So we form this really tight sort of internal relationship with our clients. And then that allows us to work directly with the hiring managers. Those are usually the scientists, boots on the ground, who want to hire somebody for their lab or their group. And we help craft the job description. We get to know them. We get to know their team. We really understand who they're looking for on a sort of holistic basis. And as scientists, I think we're really well suited to do that. We learn about the science for the company, you know, what their goals are, what the day-to-day for that candidate, that potential person might be. And then after all of that, we finally go out and engage with our candidates. So it's very much, that's the afterthought almost. It's like, okay, we've really fleshed out who this person's going to be. What is the phenotype we're looking for? And then we go look for that person. And then we have kind of firsthand knowledge because we're already working there. It's not to say we don't make mistakes. LinkedIn is LinkedIn. Some people put a ton of great information on LinkedIn and some people put nothing, but they put that they're from a lab that we know is doing maybe a specialized technique. And so sometimes we take a shot in the dark, but what that leads to is a conversation with a scientist, and they can tell us what they want, what they're doing, what they, you know, want out of life. And we can put that into our database and reach back out when we have the right thing. So I think that the candidates recognize that we have a little bit of a different skill set than the average recruiter. And even though we might make a mistake in our outreach, it doesn't come from a place of a shotgun approach. It's just, they may not have put that info on LinkedIn for us.
You briefly talked about some of the, you know, when you're recruiting for a startup, you have to start from ground zero usually. Do you have any challenges in thinking about, you know, how is someone going to fit into like a full life cycle of a company? Because, you know, startups can be unpredictable. They can undergo through massive changes very quickly if data doesn't work out. Are there any other challenges associated with recruiting for startups specifically?
Yeah, and it's something that's forefront in our mind all the time because most of our clients are at startups of one stage, life stage or another. There's a lot of stages until a company's like not a startup anymore. You know, Moderna, we talked about them earlier. They're even going through changes. They're not a huge company. They're getting there. but you know, they're now public, you know, they're still evolving. And so that never really stopped with biotechs, but the companies we usually work with, my ideal company is about maybe 10 people. They have funding, usually seed round or Series A funding. Maybe they've just been launched out of an incubator, and they are looking to grow fairly rapidly for the next 2 to 3 years. And that's the period we would work with them. During that time, you know, we hope to install their HR function for them, finally hire that head of TA and their first recruiter, and sort of work ourselves out of a job. That's the idea. But during that, you know, 3 years, that can be, as you mentioned, a pretty turbulent time for some companies. There's ups and downs with research, with results, with funding. And the beautiful thing about the biotech scene here in Boston is that there's no shortage of jobs. In fact, I can't find enough candidates. So we do have clients that go under. It does happen. And we take all of those people that we hired, plus the people that were already there, and we can pretty much just put them other places. So it's really, it's a sad thing that happens. But I really, you usually would get, often you'll get a severance period. So you'll get, you know, 3 months salary, for instance, and we can find you something before that's done. So it's not a tragedy. It's sad, but it's also just a biotech scene. And so anybody who wants to be in these smaller companies needs to be a little bit entrepreneurial themselves, definitely not risk averse. Open-minded. I think that the really exciting thing that we, you know, chat with our candidates about is how much you touch in these companies. If you are employee 15 and like the second biology employee, you're going to touch everything. You're going to be sitting in very important meetings. Like, you have a seat at the table and you could be right out of your PhD and making such an impact. And that's, I think, really attractive to our candidates. And so when we're chatting with these candidates, we really try and tease that out. Is that going to be something that they're comfortable with? They're excited about? Do they have that energy? And some candidates don't want that, and that is totally fine. But we're really upfront with them about what they're getting into. You're going to wear all the hats. You're going to do all the things. You're going to learn so much, and you can go anywhere after that.
One thing that I heard you say that was really interesting is that you, in many ways, work yourself out of a job, and that you help them to build this HR infrastructure that can be more long lasting when they've gone through, you know, their initial period of growth. And I'm sure in many ways that could maybe be templated. Every company is different and they have their own trajectory, but do you find yourself sort of building that infrastructure for multiple companies in the same way? Is it something that's kind of replicable for you now?
Somewhat, yeah. I would say every company is different and their timeline and their funding can be different. So we treat each company as an individual, but there's an evolution and it's a pretty standard one. It just may take place on different timescales. But yes, the short answer is yes. The long answer is really depends on the company. We do try to give each company the same set of tools. So our really baby companies, we have an applicant tracking system that we can put them on in-house. It's called Greenhouse. And as they get too big to use ours, we give them their own instance of Greenhouse. And this is a system that even big companies use. So it gives them a leg up in terms of their process. As companies move toward going public, they have to have certain regulatory processes in place. And we need to, you know, their hiring practices need to be standardized, replicable, fair, equitable. So we have ways of implementing all of that for them so that when an HR person does come in, it's just all laid out for them. That's really simple. But I would say the average timeline for our clients is maybe 2 to 3 years that we work with them. And, our advertising is non-existent. We just get clients word of mouth because there is a bit of a volatile nature here. People move around a lot. And so some of our clients, you know, I've worked with clients across 3 different companies, you know, depending on where they've gone. So
you mentioned sort of the booming Boston biotech industry, and this is the Boston Biotech Series. And we looked at some data from MassBioEd that showed that hiring trends for the life sciences remained really strong, both nationally and particularly in Massachusetts last year, where unfortunately many industries experienced some significant downturns. And they found that about 3% of all job postings in Massachusetts were in the life sciences, compared to about 1% nationally. And there were something like 48,000 new job postings in Massachusetts in the life sciences sector. So from the standpoint of someone who works on both ends of the recruiting spectrum, both helping with hiring managers and helping to consult with candidates, what do you think makes the Boston life sciences industry so resilient and really unique that creates this kind of ecosystem?
That's a great question. I haven't thought about what makes it tick exactly. Coming from California, there was a very strong life sciences industry in the Bay Area. We're actually seeing a bit of a migration. A lot of companies are not setting up shop in the Bay Area and instead opting for the Cambridge area. And I think it has a few factors. First of all, real estate, and it's not as densely populated here. So you can get real estate. What we're seeing is that companies are sort of expanding outward. Of course, downtown Cambridge, that Kendall Square area is the place to be, but you can't get real estate there. So a lot of biotechs are moving out, moving to different areas. There's some really interesting hubs popping up, like the Seaport is becoming a really fun biotech scene. There's just some nice little areas. Alewife is still technically in Cambridge, but there was a big Pfizer compound there. Pfizer moved out and all baby biotechs are moving in. It's a really fun little spot. We've got a few clients in there. And so we're seeing these little mini hubs, but really on the whole, the commuting time between these mini hubs is very small. It's very short. Whereas in the Bay Area, I did have a client who had one office in the Bay Area and one office in Cambridge, the main office in Cambridge. And when I was growing their Bay Area location, I was out there several times. And getting anywhere is impossible. And if you change jobs and you happen to work for a company in San Jose or Palo Alto, and now you want to work for one in San Francisco proper, you almost have to move. Like, it's not a doable commute. But in Cambridge, that's not the case, or the Boston area, that's not necessarily the case. Everything is a little bit easier, closer together. It's not as congested here. And you can still get really good land and really good properties if you go a little further out from the city. So I think that that contributes a lot. But then just the pure concentration of resources here and schools. So there's a great talent pool that's located right here in the area. And then these small companies, you know, they don't have all the resources. For instance, if they want to do animal work, they may not have a vivarium. That would be a challenge if you wanted to do one or two experiments, but you can rent hourly vivarium space and you can have them take care of your, you know, one mouse colony that you need. And so you have all of these great resources that are right at your fingertips. So I think that that's another aspect of it, but I'm not in the business of speculating, but those would be my guesses.
So I know you said you started your PhD right in 2008, which obviously was a time of substantial economic downturn and the Great Recession. And now you're operating sort of hopefully towards the tail end of the pandemic. And I'm wondering, have you noticed any changes in demand sort of for candidate hiring since the pandemic started? You know, either in terms of flexibility in work arrangements or just kind of the different types of jobs that people are hiring for right now?
Yeah, we've noticed a few really interesting changes. First of all, there are more jobs. We didn't see a slowdown. It was the opposite. I hired a lot of people for my company during the pandemic and we grew. I think that's because we offer a lot of flexibility in our model. We scale up and scale down and you kind of only pay for the time you need. So I think that was attractive to companies, especially if they were scaling for a project. Like, we had one client, Sherlock Biosciences, and they were doing a rapid COVID test. And so they scaled really rapidly to be able to meet that demand. But that wasn't going to be a long-term thing. So they didn't want to hire, of course, an internal team because they knew that that growth was sort of for a reason, right? We're building this lab. We need 40 people now. And then we need 5 people for the rest of the year. So that's where we shine. So I think that companies resonated with that. But in terms of the types of roles that we've seen, what's really fascinating is we keep track of trends in hiring, particularly sort of cost per hire. And so when I first started the company, what we'd call a research associate is a non-PhD lab-based researcher for the most part. They've always been a really hot hire. So somebody with like 5 years of industry experience, they're, you know, completely in the lab, but they definitely know what they're doing because they've got 5 years of great experience, right, you know, in the lab. They have always been a challenge to hire. That's like our number one ask. Every single company needs a ton of them to work in the lab. And yet what we've seen is a crazy inflation for that particular role. So we've seen 5 years ago, I would have hired somebody for maybe 75 in that 75,000 with no PhD. And now they're commanding the same amount as an entry-level PhD. And so we're talking, you know, low 100s, 110, something like that. And so we're really struggling with that because a lot of our clients want a long-term lab researcher, and they know that PhD level researchers are going to want to continue to grow and perhaps move up, have their own group within a few years. And so that's where this challenge is, but it's actually presenting a unique opportunity for brand new PhD grads, because that 5 years of experience in the lab, that is the profile we need. So, you know, if you're willing to maybe forgo a postdoc and go and do, you know, be in industry for at least, and you commit to being at the bench for at least 5 years, that's a really nice opportunity. And we're seeing a lot of people take advantage of that. We do not have enough non-PhD lab-based folks with 5 years of experience. They just don't exist. I can't find enough. So that's one major trend. And I think that's just a boom in the need for hands in the lab. A lot of hands-on research, just the funding is there, the projects are there, and the excitement is there. We just don't have people to do it.
Yeah. I think you brought up a really interesting point too, because I know, you know, at least when I started PhD, that was a huge topic of discussion, is whether or not to do a postdoc before going into industry, whether or not to do an industry postdoc. And no one, frankly, seemed to have an answer. And there is no right answer, right? No. So, it's good to know that, you know, PhDs can take advantage of roles like that, that, you know, you might see the description of 5 years like industry experience or 5 years lab experience, and you might not immediately translate that to, oh, well, that was my PhD.
Yeah.
So I think
absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, that said, there's a little pushback from our hiring managers always, because they think that, you know, and it's not wrong, but, you know, it is a shift. It's a mental shift. Industry is a different beast. And so not everyone sort of makes that transition well. I'd say most people do. PhDs are very resilient, but it's a very different work environment. And so you just have to be prepared for that. You know, projects get yanked at a moment's notice. It just happens. And, you know, you roll with it. Timelines, deadlines, the way you actually do the research is very different. The documentation is key, because hopefully this is going to be going to patients, which is exciting, but also it's a burden to make sure that you've done everything really well and you've documented it perfectly.
So you work with a lot of startups, and I think for this interview, we should call them baby biotechs, because I like that terminology. And there's been an interesting phenomenon. I think in part the pandemic has revealed this as a viable business model, where biotechs, especially in their early stages, will exist completely virtual. So they won't have any of their own lab space, and they will use contract research organizations and even contract manufacturing and development of products. Do you work with any of those virtual biotech companies? And do they hire PhD level scientists to sort of manage product operations? Is that something you've seen?
Yeah, that's not, none of our clients are operating in that way exactly. We have a couple of clients that are so small that they really only have like 3 to 5 people. And they, though, what they're doing is taking, so the founders are usually in the lab. They're very hands-on founders, usually coming out of academia. Then they're taking lab space in Cambridge. There are places that you can rent, you know, by the bench foot. So you can have a little lab space in Cambridge and have a presence there to manage those contract research organizations. So we don't have anyone purely in that model. I have heard of some companies going that way. But for us, and I think that, you know, they probably don't need to hire us to hire those CROs. And so if that's really their model, they're not doing a lot of internal hiring yet. But the answer is yes, they would need somebody with the scientific expertise to plan the experiments, transfer those to CROs, evaluate the data, the quality, the work quality, all of that. So yes, that is definitely an opportunity for PhD level researchers.
And on that note, I guess, you know, going into the kind of like interview tips and tricks and, you know, what not to do kind of section, because I'm sure that's what everyone is curious, especially when they're looking for a job the first time away from academia. I know that's certainly the top of my mind. So are there any common, you know, mistakes that you typically see like first time job seekers making when they interview for a biotech position?
Yeah, there are a few things that you can definitely do. We have some resources on our website, kind of rudimentary, but your listeners can go and there's a section where we outline how to really make your LinkedIn profile shine so you're found in the first place. We look at it from a recruiter's point of view, like what do we see? What do we search? What can we search? And how can you optimize your profile so you're found? That's one thing you can do before the interview. For the interview itself, we have some tips and tricks as well. But what we're seeing is, I don't think Zoom interviews are going anywhere. Companies are comfortable with them now. It means that a long distance candidate does not need to be flown in on, you know, the first pass interview. I think we will get back to flying people in to see the space. But, you know, at the same time, I had one client grow 70 heads without meeting a single person in person during the pandemic. Like, companies are just comfortable with that now. So really getting good at Zoom, your Zoom interviews, that's key. So what we find, a lot of times we'll debrief with our hiring teams after an interview and they'll say, oh, the candidate looked distracted, you know, and if you're looking around, maybe your camera's not centered, you know, you're not making eye contact, so to speak. It's weird because you end up looking kind of at yourself, right? But you have to do that for an interview unless you really set up your, I'm on Zoom all day long. So I've set up my workspace so that I can see you guys and also still be looking toward the camera. But it's really, really hard for people who aren't used to that. So practice. There's no harm in practicing. Grab a friend on Zoom and see how that looks. Making sure that your background isn't distracting. It doesn't have to be perfect. It doesn't have to be a white wall, but like your laundry shouldn't be back there. You know, so just kind of setting yourself up as sort of a put together person, because you would do that if you were going on site, right? It's just that, oops, now you have to do it in your house. So make sure that that kind of looks okay. But other than that, I mean, it's the standard stuff. It's so hard. There's no like deep secret that I can impart that you haven't already heard if you're looking for jobs. You have to be prepared with meaningful questions. You'll have the interviewer list ahead of time. As a scientist, go read a couple of papers, like get yourself ready so that you have some things to talk about. You don't need to do it in some weird show-offy way. Like, I was reading your paper from the 80s and da, da, da. You don't need to do that. But, you know, understanding that science and being conversational about it, like that is what we do, right? So that's a big one. And I think also just, you know, letting a little personality show through, because especially when they're not, if you're not meeting in person, if you're doing Zoom, it is really hard to know if you're going to just click with somebody. Whereas on site, you know, there might be a lunch, there'd be some sort of in-between interviews, some little downtime moments when they can glimpse who you might be. So trying to impart that through Zoom, it's really hard, but you know, do your best. that's my main thing is Zoom is going to stay for a while, if not indefinitely, as a first step.
I'm glad you brought that up. Not terribly long ago, went through, you know, an interview process, and that was my first one since starting grad school. And it, like all of that I had to go through in my head in the beginning that I would have just never thought about before. So rearranging the apartment to make it look nice.
Yeah.
Forgetting like just basic things. So I'm actually really glad you brought that up. I wish someone flat out told me that.
You know, and investing in lighting, if you're going to be working even partly remotely, it seems so ridiculous, but investing in some good lighting. Doesn't have to be like professional grade, but just like a small ring light, buy one for $10 at Target, and a decent microphone that is not a headset microphone. I have to say that you guys are probably using them for your podcast. I've got a nice microphone that I use for every single meeting I do. It's just the way we communicate now. We're here in the virtual, which I think is great. I think it's great for the environment. It's great for so many reasons, you know, that we can do more virtually, but you have to set yourself up too for success.
So you've talked a lot about how you hire for startups and in particular, somebody going into a scientist position at a startup should have, you know, certain qualities, entrepreneurial, self-starter. What about somebody who is looking to work in a scientist position at a big biotech or large pharma company? You may not have worked with so many of them, but can you impart some wisdom on sort of what qualities make someone a good candidate in that setting?
Absolutely. And I can talk about that actually, because many of our hiring managers came from big pharma and they were excited. They're later in their career and they wanted to have a big impact at a small company. And so this was sort of like a second career almost for them to come here. So I've been able to pick some of their brains. It's really fascinating. The difference is, there are a lot of differences. The main difference is that I think would matter to your listeners would be there's a different mentality at the two. So biotech, startup biotechs are fast paced. It's all hands on deck and you really have to be very comfortable doing different things every day. And that really appeals to some people. That appeals to me. In grad school, if I had, you know, too many of the same type of experiment in a row, like I'd get bored and I would crave some variety in my day. So if that is you, you may be more comfortable in a small biotech where you would be asked to like, oh, nobody knows how to do this. Like who wants to learn it? Like who owns this? And you just like grad school may be the only one in the whole company who knows how to do a thing because you just went and learned it. And you have to now go negotiate with the vendors and do all of the things that maybe you did in grad school. I don't know. That's what I had to do in my lab. So I was comfortable with that and I liked that. And I couldn't imagine not doing that. If though, you are the type of person who really enjoys getting extremely good at one thing and just, you know, excelling in that space, then Big Pharma could offer that opportunity for you. So if you are passionate about NMR, we'll go back to NMR, you're not going to have an NMR at a small biotech. Like that's just not a thing that you will have access to. We would use a CRO for that if we needed NMR time, right? So if you wanted to do that, you might need to look for a big pharma that has an NMR department. And you probably would live in New York someplace where there isn't a lot of seismic activity and you would have a whole group of NMRs and you would go out there and, you know, do NMR and be the world expert in whatever, you know, drug product you're working on. And that could be really fulfilling to you. So just a really different way of looking at things. There are also differences in the pay structure and the benefits for the different companies. So in startups, you're often, startups pay a living wage. That if you have heard that that's not a reality, that's a myth. Startups have to. There's no way we would be able to compete for talent. So startups pay sometimes even better in terms of base salary than some of the big pharma companies do, but the benefits can be a little bit different. Often benefits are added sort of one by one. Health insurance is standard. You won't find a company that's not offering that for the most part, but you may find different levels of other benefits like 401k match may or may not be there. You may or may not have access to some of the other sort of nice to have benefits. And those are usually added in over time up until the point when a company goes public. And then there still might be things added. You might get equity, though. That might be part of your compensation package. Now, that's not worth anything until the company either goes public or is acquired. So there has to be some sort of a liquidity event, we call it, when you are able to then take your equity and convert it into cash or stock. And so you might not know what that's worth, but that's kind of part of the fun. If you're being paid a living wage and you're really influencing whatever's going on at this company, right? And they make it big time, that could be worth a lot of money. I know a lot of people who bought houses with that equity, you know, that can be really lucrative, but nobody knows. And that's the fun of a startup. So you wouldn't necessarily know your whole compensation package. Whereas at Big Pharma, you might get a stock option or even an RSU, which that's like a grant of stock. So you might know the value of that. It might depend on what the stock market's doing, but you can calculate that. You know what that's worth. You could sell it if you wanted to. So there's a lot of differences in terms of that. So a lot of people look at Big Pharma as more stable. Again, I think that's a myth. I've seen entire departments at Big Pharma laid off with zero notice. And often that's a little harder even than biotech layoffs, because they might be, again, so specialized. What do you do with that NMR group? Like, where do they go? Right. So that might be a little bit challenging. Whereas a small biotech person, they are so versatile. They are a jack of all trades and they can do anything anywhere. So does that answer your question? It's sort of long-winded, but
yeah. So speaking about benefits and total compensation and all of these, big finance terms. I think one thing that's really intimidating for a lot of PhDs and trying to get their first job is the negotiation. So you've sort of made it to the goal line, to use an analogy, and you want to prove your worth, and you think that, it's a natural process, negotiation is. But I think it can be intimidating for a lot of people. Do you have resources to help with that, or do you have suggestions that you can offer now?
That is really challenging. We do that totally differently than headhunters will do it, or than internal recruiters will do it. So if you're working with a headhunter and they're not affiliated with the company, I think it's fair to ask them what their fee model is. First of all, never pay a recruiter to do anything for you. You should never be paying for recruiting services. They are getting paid through the company in some way. But I think it's fair to figure out what kind of skin does that person have in this game to understand what they might be counseling you in terms of compensation. You don't want to go to Glassdoor. A lot of people think, I get a lot of candidates to say, well, I looked at Glassdoor and a scientist could be making from 90,000 to 180,000. Like, yep, that's pretty much the range, because it's self-reported, and a scientist at one company could be totally different than another. And we see a lot of weird titling, especially at small companies. We sometimes have to counsel our small clients, like, well, let's change your titling because that doesn't make any sense in this industry. But, if somebody hasn't said that to them, then suddenly you've got a brand new PhD with a VP level title making 90,000. This doesn't make any sense anywhere, but it could be reported on Glassdoor. So just a fair warning, that's it's a very erroneous system on Glassdoor. But I think it's fair to ask friends and colleagues that have left, that have maybe gone to a similar place. That's where LinkedIn comes in. Just go and, see what your friends and colleagues are doing. They should be forthcoming. That's really important for you to know sort of what the landscape looks like in a given area. And it's going to be different in Cambridge than it is in the Bay Area or in North Carolina. So really getting to know that in your area. And then when you come to the negotiation table, with my company at least, we're really upfront with candidates about how our company is, like what they're able to pay. And we do have to maintain what's called internal equity. So it's something even our smallest clients, we counsel them, like, let's get your salary ladder set now. It needs to be competitive for the area. We need to set it now. And then every person we bring in needs to conform to that salary ladder so that in a year, you're not doing salary adjustments, which is really painful. So you don't want to be doing that. So we try and help our clients to come to that early. And then we talk to our candidates very candidly about salary and what to expect and how the whole compensation package works. And I never mind if somebody wants to negotiate their package. but I'm going to be really upfront with them if it's, you know, not in the realm of possibility, so that they have time to think about that and make other plans if that's not going to work for them.
To kind of flip it back onto the recruiting side. So one of the goals of this podcast is to introduce PhD level scientists to different careers. And we haven't really talked to anyone in the recruiting field. And so if someone, one of our listeners, is interested in scientific recruiting as a career, what qualities do you think are especially important? And what do you look for in hiring managers? And how would they maybe go about exploring that career opportunity a little bit more?
Sure. So when I am interviewing people to join my team for my company, I always just want to explore their interest in connecting with scientists, because I think the thing that makes somebody happy in my company sort of long-term is the excitement about getting a new client, learning their science, talking to those hiring managers, talking to candidates. It's a lot of talking. So they have to be comfortable with that. I am not an extrovert. That's not a requirement. I'm actually an introverted extrovert. I should say an extroverted introvert. I think that's my personality type. But I enjoy talking to people, but it can be exhausting for me. But I enjoy it. I do like people, and I like talking about science, and I like talking to people. So that's a requirement, because this job is all talking, at least for the first few years. My company's young though. And so we have about 26 full-time employees. And then we have some part-time employees and contractors. And those people who have been with me for several years now are actually creating their own roles in my company, as far as like what it looks like to take us to the next level. We have a lot of places that we want to go. So that's exciting. We've got one person moving into kind of my job, managing recruitment operations. We've got somebody doing with actually Spencer. If you know Spencer, he does our career development, our outreach, working with different groups in the community, whether it's here in Cambridge or elsewhere, and sort of working with the candidate side on that. We've got business development things going on. So there's a lot of ways to go, from recruiting. I would say that recruiting itself is probably not a full, like, a career. It is in the sense that you'll do it for a few years, but it'll probably lead to something else, whether it's HR, moving into a company. I could see some of our people, for instance, leaving me eventually, which would be so sad, but I'd be excited for them because they would go in and maybe be a head of talent acquisition within, in-house. So they'd be that person we hire eventually to sort of replace us for the operations piece. So things like that, I think there's a lot of ways to go there. But I think all of that comes down to communication. You have to really enjoy. There's no way that I can see forward if you don't enjoy talking to a lot of different people. So that's my thing. When I do interview people, I'm really, really upfront with them, though. And I think this is important for your listeners to know. We have a lot of pushback from our hiring managers, and those are the people within the company, like a head of biology, head of chemistry, whatever. They're hiring for their groups. We have a lot of pushback if a candidate has ever left the bench and is trying to come back. That is a really challenging thing to do. There's a lot of stigma around that. Something we try and help our hiring managers to overcome, because there are really valid reasons for somebody to do that. But it is a challenge. So if your listeners are thinking of a career away from the bench, it's probably a permanent away from the bench. It's not that they couldn't come back and be back at the bench at some point. It would be challenging, be very difficult. So I'm really upfront with people who are considering, leaving their lab, venturing out away from the bench, just because it may not be something that's easy to undo if they should want to do that and think, never mind, I'm going to go back to the bench and be a biologist. Yeah.
Well, I think we appreciate that. Yeah. We appreciate that honesty. Yeah.
Yeah. That said, we are hiring. So if any of your listeners want to get in touch, I would love to chat, because we are still growing, and we kind of are always challenged by our own internal personnel or a need for more.
Looking for a PhD level or earlier?
Yeah.
Yeah, we're looking for folks who are finished with their PhD or just about to be finished with their PhD. When we always start people, again, because recruiting is not for everybody, and there's almost no way to figure that out without doing it. So we have the opportunity for people to try us, try before they buy. We actually have people come on for a short term as contractors to see if they enjoy it. It's a thing that they might want to do full time, and then we'll bring them on full time. So there's often that transition, and that's been really successful for many of our people. If not, I think all but two of my PhD level recruiters gave us a try before they decided to make that switch. Yeah.
Well, I don't know if we've had anyone directly hired through listening to the podcast. So hopefully a good candidate will reach out. That could be the first instance of that.
That would be great. And on our website, there's a place for candidates to actually just put their information in to just register with us. So all of our jobs are not on our website. So I should just say that we don't advertise everything there because we're spread across so many companies with so many systems. So there's sort of a job seeker registration. So if you are listening and want a lab-based job or a job in biotech, feel free to register. That puts you in the system. And we do have an AI tool that is constantly looking at those new people and pairing them with potential jobs. So while we have a database that has almost 100,000 candidates in it, you won't be lost. We've got an AI tool that helps us to not lose people.
Yeah, thank you. Well, thank you, Karina, for giving us a window into the world of hiring in the life sciences.
My pleasure. This was really fun. I hope to connect with some of your listeners at some point.
Great.
Thank you for joining us. Don't forget to follow Hopkins Biotech Podcast on social media at Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn, or Twitter for updates about upcoming guests, and visit us at hopkinsbiotechpodcast.com to check out our full catalog of episodes. I'm Joe Varielli.
I'm Jenna Glatzer.
Thank you for listening.